to life, back to reality, back to what is not month end. Yes. Beginning of the new month.
Yeah.
did you see how the streets were today?
Well, yeah.
It's sunny. Just like last week.
Mm-hmm.
But less people.
Less people because their money's spent already?
Yeah, well, they're not being careful. They're not being careful about it.
Yeah.
And it's always interesting to see the month end, the weekend of month end, and the weekend after.
Yeah.
And then the weekend that follows the weekend after.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I never noticed it because in Australia I was getting paid monthly.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really noticed it because you're out on R&R and everybody goes to different areas where they live and stuff. So you don't really notice it. But I got to pay attention to that now.
I challenge you to pay attention. I think the next one will be, let's see.
It'll be the end of what, August?
Yeah, I'm trying to see what date exactly. So probably the date of the, probably 24th, 23rd, 24th. Somewhere there.
Yeah. I don't know how people do it in New Zealand, getting paid monthly. Like, no.
Well, it's all about discipline.
Yeah. Discipline with what? Like, I can
with
be disciplined when there's
you
copious.
Have.
You know, I can be disciplined when there's copious amounts to be disciplined with. When there's very little, I just feel like it's, struggle years.
Please do not go and live in South Africa because you will have a huge problem.
Because monthly?
When they get that monthly salary,
I
tell you. But anyway, welcome to the Black House right here on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And yes, but before we start on what we're still carrying on with our history of black diaspora presence from the 1700s. We're getting into it. But before we do that, what the FBI? What the heck is going on?
Welcome, guys.
You know, like, in China, listen. Everybody in New Zealand shops from Shein, Temu, or who's the other one? AliExpress.
Yeah.
We all do.
Yeah.
I mean, I would buy my food from China right now if they sold it on Shein because everything's too expensive in New Zealand.
It's weird. When we were growing up, we used to have, you know, especially in, there was a song that was actually, it was derogatory actually when I started to think of it. It rhymed with Hong Kong.
Mm.
But they used to talk about, you know, wearing fake stuff and referencing China.
Which is crazy because everything's made in China.
Exactly.
Even the authentic stuff is made. Like China came out, remember?
But that's what was sold to us.
Yeah.
To say that the fake stuff is made in China. The real stuff is made in Parc de Princes in France something.
I think the fakeness is the people who want to get their stuff made in China and not give China the credit that it was made in China.
Of course,
that's the fake stuff.
I mean, that's what the powers that be used to do, just to make sure that, you know, our market believes that we made it, but in actual fact, it's these other guys who made it. And I'm so glad that there's things like TikTok, all social media platforms that have just come up now that are exposing the truth.
Yeah, and saying that stuff is actually made here.
Exactly.
And come get some. And yes, give me that Adidas. Where is the factory? If anybody knows where the factory is that makes Adidas clothes in China, please send the Black House a quick message and a link, please.
I didn't know you were a three-stripe fan as well.
I grew up in the 80s, hip-hop, of course I...
Oh yeah, it makes sense.
I've even got fake Adidas sneakers with four stripes.
You know who made me get into Adidas? It was Missy Elliott.
Oh yeah, I loved her stuff.
I love to see the fact that she's also still on some billboards when it comes to Adidas. I actually noticed that this past week, I think it was about 2 days ago actually, when I just happened to catch the second half of Manchester United's tour in the US. Then they were in the editor store signing signatures and everything on people's regalia.
Yeah.
Then guess what I see on the poster? Missy. So relevant to today.
Adidas was the uniform for the netball teams.
Yeah.
So our tracksuit was those classic Adidas. And I had a green one and I had a blue one. And then I saw this old man running down the street in Abel Tasman Street. And he was wearing a green classic with three stripes.
Please tell me you left him alone.
No, I didn't. Of course I didn't. I said, where did you get that tracksuit from? And so he gave me some tips. And I was just like, when I went and saw the prices though, I was like, nah, I need the Chinese factory that's making the Adidas. Anybody knows the link to that place, send it to the Black House.
German engineering, they say. Anyway, yeah. moving right along. We have a reminder today. It's a concert show.
Concert tonight. Yeah, it's in Duna.
Duna is at Moon. Where is Moon?
Moon is on Rutherford Street in Newtown.
Okay.
It's a cool little live venue place, and he's going to be joined by Taryn and KB the DJ, so you know KB.
Yeah, I know KB.
So KB's, he's going to be down
phenomenal.
There. And yeah, get your tickets. I'm already in because he's like my third kid, and and it's celebrating his go high. It's a gift from Induna's younger self to the artist he is today. It's so cool. Such a cool idea. So yeah, be down there tonight, 9:30. The show starts at 9:30. The doors open at 9. So.
Just in case you're wondering who Induna is, he's a self-taught artist and producer, and he blends Afropop with the vibrant spirit of his South African heritage.
Yeah.
He was recently honored with the Young Global Achiever Award at the 2024 Trust Awards in London. Yeah,
so amazing. And he's such a self-starter. Like, he's just, I can do anything, and I'm just going to do it. And he's so cool like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if you're not doing anything tonight, come down to Newtown. Newtown always rocks anyway because, you know, it's the hood. And
that's where life is.
That's where the life is. Come down there. It'll be a really good night. And our other notice.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm so giddy over this. You know, I've been reading that book. Last week we were talking about black convicts, and I've been reading that book, and I thought, I'm going to write to Scintilla.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a letter back.
Wow.
And we're going to organize something. And I've talked to somebody, and she's going to help me with it. And, yeah, we're going to organize something. We've got to make it happen. We have to make it happen.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. So I wish we could. Do you want to read the letter? Do you want to?
I don't want to read the letter. That's
giving them too much.
I don't read the letter. Only to say that she's also Tanzanian, so I'm just going to put that out there.
Homegirl.
My homegirl.
Home
yeah, my homegirl's coming down. Hopefully. And we do want to have a showing of the doco as well. So.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so amazing woman, amazing book. If you haven't read Black Convicts, get the book, get the Audible like me. Have a listen, it'll blow your mind.
I think what we should do actually is to have a couple of excerpts from the book, just, you know, just to
play on air.
Yeah, probably like 30 seconds or something.
You could do that for the next one.
A little teaser. Yeah,
yeah,
that'll be nice.
I was thinking that.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So let's get on with it. So we're talking about the Sealers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Story time. I feel like sitting on the floor, but you know. And Tony needs to organize a way to get these microphones like down there so that I can sit down, cross my legs, and, you know,
like, so live and listen to the story.
I have a little fire blowing. No, the fires don't blow. A little fire glowing in the corner there. Yeah,
you know, like, have story time.
Yeah.
So story time. We're talking about the Sealers.
Yeah.
Now the Sealers first started appearing on New Zealand shores like 17. I think the first one was 17. Let me get the right date. 17. I'm scrolling. First sealing. Dusky Sound, 1792.
1792, okay.
So they came before the Whalers started coming down. The Sealers were coming down, and the Sealers were also coming across from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a look. Look, I went and had a look at some of these islands that they went to besides, you know, around Fovo Strait in the bottom of the South Island. And it's really strange when you go onto maps and you start looking for these islands.
Yeah.
And they're south-south-east of New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole lot of these little islands. So because they're so small, I had to like all of them and save them and put them as favourites so a little love heart would appear. Because when you pull back out and try to... You can't see them.
I actually noticed that the other... I think it was about a month ago. I actually started my quest in seeing the islands that are around New Zealand because at first I thought, New Zealand is such a small island.
Yeah.
And I was like, no.
It's surrounded by tiny, tiny islands. Yeah.
And then when you look at the Fijis and stuff like that, you're like, you don't really see this on the map.
Yeah.
Unless you really zoom.
You zoom in and you can see that. And then you can see the houses on them.
Oh, wow.
And so I had a look at some of these islands, and some of them are pretty. Wow. So what they used to do was they'd dump their sailing crews on these islands and leave them there. And they would seal, right, and kill all these seals and get all the furs together and, you know, oil, because they get oil from seals. They could get oil from elephant seals. And then the ship would have to come back to collect them. So they could be stuck there for 6 months, 8 months. And when you go and zoom in on these maps, like one island I looked at, I think it was, let me see, I think it was Auckland Island. It's just tussock. There's no shelter, there's no trees, nothing.
What I wonder also is that with these islands that they used to leave them on, what measures of sustenance do they have?
Well, they get left with like things like flour, you know, basics that they could make stuff from. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of them got scurvy and whatnot while they're out there, because like being on a ship, you're pretty much abandoned to do your job. And then the ship comes back 6 months later and picks you up and picks your stuff up that you've all killed and takes you back to wherever you came from. So, you know, I was just looking at these places on the map and how isolated they were, and also cold, because now you're getting right down into, you know, you're heading towards Antarctica.
I was about to say.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
if we thought South Island was cold.
Yeah. I mean, there's even islands there called Tahirua Torifa. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Right? I was like, what? So you got places like Auckland Island and, well, I won't read them out. It's easy. Yeah, but, like, you'll have to like them and love them to see where they are. I could show you, like, right now because I just pulled it up. But, you know, with the story about the sealers, you got to put it in the context of what Britain was doing globally.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, this is what made it really, this whole researching this really interesting to me, because I'd never found New Zealand history interesting. I never found it interesting. And I think the moment that I realized, wait, there were African people here, people from the islands around Africa that were picked up, people who are West Indian that were here, and we don't talk about them. That's what when it became interesting to me.
Yeah,
and I was like, yeah, we got to look at this. Somebody's got to look at it, and there have been people looking at it. So there's a couple of people, for example, a guy called Robbie Shilliam.
Okay.
Robbie Shilliam's, he's a lecturer. I think his background's sociology and, he's very intellectual. Let's put it that way. I haven't pulled up his stats. But he's written a book called The Black Pacific, and he's got a really interesting website called The Disorder of Things, where he talks about the stories that he's heard when he's been on marae about with Māori, who were talking about their ancestors actually being African and stuff. But what I've found while I'm doing all of this is that the New Zealand records have been extremely whitewashed. Most of the information that I'm able to pull up digitally, like on my laptop and stuff, it's coming from offshore. It's coming from where whaling ships came from, or it's coming from where archives are stored in Australia, and maybe there's some digital stuff that you can access.
So it's kind of like a plane that leaves where it departed from, but doesn't really make it to where it's going to.
Or else it's just been left out of the conversation, even though there has been some, I have come across some articles where people have written about this, and even very recently. But the other thing that was really pulling me away from when I'm looking at, I'm trying to find sealers and sealers' names and looking at the ships that they might have travelled on down to New Zealand or around New Zealand waters and stuff, I kept getting pulled over to the whole British colonial expansion of empire and the use of slave of the slave trade, right? Mm-hmm. And where they were, you know, Britain in the 1700s, when until the mid 1800s, actually, Britain was the largest transporter of enslaved Africans.
Yes.
Right? And they transported about 3.1 million Africans across the Atlantic. So the, you know, and the Royal African Company was chartered in 1672, giving the English crown monopoly over British trade on the West African coast, including the slave trade. You know, so they had a lot of power.
When you talk about that number, 3.1 million,
mm-hmm.
For me that seems a bit...
Big?
No.
No, small?
Small.
Okay.
Yeah, it seems a little small. Also, big
because
as...
Because I'm not looking at the Americans. I'm trying not to look at the American slave trade. I'm only wanting to... Because you'll get off on a whole other tangent, right?
But I have a theory when it comes to that, you mm-hmm. know, the transportation of slaves and stuff. 3.1 million, how many vessels do you need for that? And in that long,
well,
thinking also the fact that some of them also, you know, died at sea and all the like.
And the fact that Britain had to keep importing slaves to run their sugar plantations, because the life of a slave on their sugar plantations in like Bermuda and around the Caribbean and that was very short.
Yeah.
And they hadn't gotten the life of a slave on those plantations. It was pretty wretched, you know, like, well, that's a term they use like a lot.
Yeah.
You know, malnutrition, babies wouldn't last very long.
Exactly. The infant mortality rate was really high.
And when your whole crop has gone from being, you know, maybe multiple different crops, it's all become sugar, then food runs out.
Of course, yeah.
So you have to keep having ships going to Africa to get more slaves to replace the ones that don't last. And that was a continuous thing all during this period of time that New Zealand was first being surrounded by whalers and sealers and then whalers mm-hmm. before colonialism in 1840. This was all going on globally with the expansion of the British Empire. Yeah. And there's a really interesting YouTube video I that talked about blood. It's called Blood and Sugar.
Blood and Sugar, okay.
And it talks, and the guy goes through a lot of documents that, because he's a specialist in history, this guy, and he goes through like why, you know, Britain had to keep importing, keep replacing everywhere they went.
Yeah.
And they weren't very nice. You know, they weren't good. There was no, oh, we're a good slave owner
sort of thing.
You know, like you were a product. You had to produce a product. You're a real cog in the wheel, whipped and beaten and thing. And their sugar plantations worked 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, when you talk about the British slave trade and, you know, them going and importing slaves from Africa and wherever else they would import them from, I like to always go on a segue and just, you know, look at the comedic side of things. There's a guy called Trevor Noah, a South African comedian.
Mm-hmm.
If you just Google Trevor Noah, the British and Indians, just watch that short clip.
Right.
You have a little bit of a laugh and it just gives you an idea of how, you know, colonialism sort of started, but in a funny way from Trevor Noah's perspective.
Yeah. And it's funny you brought up Indians because Lascars, and I was like, what are Lascars?
Yeah.
And Lascars were another people that were involved with the sealing.
Yeah.
And I think, if I'm not wrong, they were actually getting transported around British colonies for different reasons. But when I looked up what are Lascars, they were Somali.
Oh.
Well, I thought they were Indian, so there was a description, but they, you know, like they had another name for Indian people, which was Genus or something like that. And Lascars were Somali, and they were around that area,
mm-hmm.
that top northern area, mm-hmm. yeah, that had either gotten moved from one place to another place. And yeah, they were involved in sealing as well and the ships. And when you think about, you know, Somali and working on the sea, makes a lot of sense to me that if a whaling ship or a sealing ship came sailing that way,
mm-hmm.
or anywhere around there, that if there's an opportunity to make money, why wouldn't you if you already live at the sea anyway?
I mean, you would, definitely. And I mean, it's also argued that some of the people who actually got wealthy off slavery were indeed our people by selling our people to the British.
Mm.
And, you know,
there was all these arrangements made up.
Mm.
So most of the slaves in the British slave trade were the Gold Coast, Bida Benin, Bida Biafra, Sierra Leone, Senegal, Angola, Gambia. And they were taken to places like Caribbean colonies, Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua, St. Kitts, North America, specifically Virginia, Carolinas and Georgia, South America, especially British Guyana, and British sugar plantations were the main destinations because of the demand for labor.
Yeah.
Right. And then I got a real, like, oh, okay, because I've always grown up hearing that New Zealand had no slavery links whatsoever.
Mm.
Like, we're not. New Zealand never had slavery links. Well, in actual fact, that's a big fat lie.
Wow. Okay.
Big fat lie.
Tell me more.
Individuals and institutions that benefited from slavery often shifted their focus to settler colonies after abolition, and New Zealand was a fresh site for profit, land acquisition, and social engineering. So prominent settlers and investors in the New Zealand Company, which colonised Wellington, Nelson, and other areas, had financial or familiar ties to slavery. For example, Edward Gibbon Wakefield's family and allies had links to colonial trade and political circles shaped by slavery wealth. And the UCL Legacies of British Slave Ownership database shows many British MPs, elites who helped create policy for New Zealand colonisation, were slave owners or beneficial of it.
Mm.
Which blew me away. Man, yeah, links again. So, and also, so the picture is right now you've got the British slave trade happening in particular parts of the world.
Mm.
At the same time, Britain is expanding their empire.
Okay.
And, people who were slaved from Africa to the Caribbean, if they got in any trouble or anything that upset anybody in the colonies, Britain would then send them as convicts to places like Bermuda or Barbados and eventually Australia.
Okay.
Right? So Australia wasn't the first penal colony. It was probably the third or fourth.
But it's the most popular one.
It's the most popular one. It's the biggest one.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the biggest open air. It was the biggest open air prison you could go to.
Jeez, yeah.
You know? And so, like, that made me look through, okay, the list of black convicts transported to Australia on in Scintilla Shangaipi's book. She's got a list. It's like, oh, it's a massive list. Like, I was thinking, you know, maybe they were in the hundreds. No, they were in the thousands.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Jeez.
And not all of the ones I would think would be actually on that list. There's probably more.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But the way that they were named, usually things like if there was a description of their appearance, they might not say, oh, they're definitely African or they're black or they're, you know, the N-word or whatever. They'd use things
why
like,
is that? Why would that be?
I'm not sure why that is. I'm sure somebody's written about that because I think I learnt from black convicts, Scintilla's book, that person of colour was actually a term used in slavery. That's where it came from. I always thought it was something that came from a more modern era. I didn't realise that
It does sound like it's relatively modern.
Yeah. And like, I don't know. The first time I heard it was probably about 1980.
To be honest, I also don't understand it. It's, for me, it's like, okay.
Well, I know when I was working, when I was a secretary for the New Plymouth Women's Centre, and it was sort of Māori and Pākehā, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
I was deemed the person of colour because I didn't fit any of those. That was the first time I heard it. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
But, so now you've got a convict colony in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
They've got setting up their sugar plantations in North Australia.
Yeah.
right? So the British wants more sugar. Australia is actually the largest producer of sugar in the world right now.
That makes me wonder. At that particular point in time, if you look at current trade routes and the routes to getting the product to the British colonies and Britain itself,
yeah,
I wonder how profitable it was. Because I always think, whenever I look at a business, I think, okay, if I have to move this product from A to B,
yeah,
will it be profitable?
Well, like, that's... I wasn't thinking about it so much like that, but yeah. I was thinking, it's not like all production was centered in China, yeah, like it is today, right? And so everybody has to negotiate with China. There were, you know, sugar was being made in these different areas, you know, where the British were.
Mm-hmm.
The British would take their sugar and rum,
yeah,
because you can distill rum from, you know, from sugar, mm-hmm, molasses makes the rum, yes, right? So they'd take their sugar and they would exchange it for something somewhere else. So people who, you know, so there'd be, they called it mercantile trading.
Yeah.
And the way I understand that, but if anybody understands this word better than I do right now.
It sounds like barter trade.
Like there's bartering and there's profit.
Yes, yes, yes.
So, but not everybody could make everything.
True, because if right? I say I leave my if I leave Newtown on my way into town, I must pass by the basin there. When I pass by the basin, I might find someone who's got condensed milk. Then, you know, give them some sugar cane in place of condensed milk,
and maybe some, you know, some extra dollars and gold and whatever else you got.
And
you
then by the time I get into the CBD, I've got, you know, two products. Then I must probably get a third one.
Yeah.
Barter one of the two products for the third one.
Because they're not available in these other places.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, that's what globalization has changed.
Yes, true.
Is that now, I don't know if we're doing that as much now because, you know, like, well, we know where the resources are. It's Africa, Australia, big resource countries, Canada,
mm-hmm,
right? So you have to get your iron ore from X
to
be able to take it over there to do B or whatever, you know, but... Then I think it was even more spread out.
Yeah.
So what I was thinking, like, and why the rush for seals? Why did you want seals? Well, they needed them for oil, right, for their lamps, something that burned clean. The meat, the fur for clothing, hats, shoes, yada-da-yada-da. But also they traded seal skins and fur and what have you for tea, which wasn't available over there.
Yeah.
Right? Sugar, from what I can tell, sugar was available, it was a Far East thing before it became a British thing.
Mm.
So where in the Far East, I'm not sure,
because
I don't think sugar grows in China. I think probably maybe Middle East.
Yeah.
Where it's warmer.
I mean, that's why you find this side of things are a whole lot sweeter.
So China had the Silk Road,
yes,
you know, and these were other trading things. And so you're diversifying by not just dealing in sugar and slaves, but now you're dealing in seals and whales.
I'm not going to let you just pass over that one. You said China had the what? The Silk Road.
Silk Road, yeah.
Okay.
So that was a trading route, and it went all the way from Africa right across to China, through India, everywhere. And so they dominated that for ages, but there were things that when Britain got into its expansion,
mm-hmm,
you know, of empire, there were things that they could get from their colonies that they took over and colonized and invaded and stole. And then they could take that to a trading hub that was actually much bigger, thousands of years old.
You know, the fact that you're so engrossed in this that you didn't even see the double entente that you mentioned.
What was that?
The silk?
Mm.
The silk what?
Silk Road.
Okay. And China produces what these days?
Silk.
And what do we get a lot from China?
Clothes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Play a song. We need a break. I need a break. You're making me think too hard.
Come on, man. It was right there. Like you literally walked into it and walked out of it and walked back into it. Walked out of it and looked at it again. And then you realize, like, damn, this is where I was at.
So the whole thing with sealing is that sealing in New Zealand was coming up.
Yeah.
At a time when all of this other stuff was going on politically and geographically around first the exploration and then the colonization of New Zealand. But we're looking at those early days before they actually said, yeah, we're gonna take over this joint.
Yeah.
And New Zealand was very multicultural. Sealing created multicultural crews, but we can go into that. You got a song?
You can get a song right here, Dr. Philip Tabane.
Okay, there you go.
So let's get into that one. This is, Wellington Access Radio, the Black House, right here. And yeah, man, Silk Road.
The Silk Road.
I'm still stuck.
You hadn't heard of the Silk Road.
Let's take a musical break. Dr. Philip Tabane by Malcolm Gianni Trio. I actually missed
very chill.
I missed the opportunity to watch these guys. There's a movement that happens every Thursday in Pretoria, South Africa, and it's called Black Labone, which means Black Thursday. So run by a couple of friends of mine. Love it. I'm actually just going to plug them now because they're celebrating the 8th year of Black Labone this coming Thursday.
Wow.
So if you're in Pretoria, South Africa, make sure you go for the Earth Day. Yeah, Black Labone.
I don't think we reached that far, but friends, tell your friends.
Yeah. No, I think we do reach somehow the word spreads. So they're going to be celebrating the Earth Day, the 8th Earth Day this coming Thursday, and it's a big fest.
Oh, nice.
I've DJed there before, and I remember when I first DJed that site, I was told strictly no house.
No house.
Yes. Because House has got a platform for it. Amapiano has a platform for it, and everything else has a platform. But you want to bring up those rare grooves. You want to bring up the jazz. You know, that's one place where you can get to play jazz and everyone just enjoys it. You play.
Is it a very sort of like flash sort of event? Like you can turn up in suits and.
No. It's laid back. You can turn up. Okay, let me not say pajamas. You can come as you are, basically. Type of vibe. I'll say we're all about it because I'm still part of the family. We're all about the music and good vibes. That's where I was actually introduced to some artists like Bokani Daya. A whole lot of artists, man.
You need to drop me some of these links so I can add them to my playlist.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Like Mahatsela More, I've worked with him before. We were in a band together way back before he started releasing stuff. And
that's right. Yeah. You're a musician too, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
What instruments do you play?
Piano, bass, drums, percussion.
All rounder?
Yeah.
You in any band here at the moment?
Nah.
Why not?
Nah. I don't want to be in a band for now.
Do you play guitar?
I do play guitar.
Have you got one?
Yeah. I'm not interested in playing right now.
Oh, okay.
Not yet.
Why?
I've got my piano in the house.
Yeah.
I think I haven't touched it in like a month or something.
Mm.
Yeah, I really don't have time for it.
Oh.
I've been playing for like 24 years, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
I play the vuvuzela. And the whistle.
For a moment there, I was just like, I'm not going to laugh. I'm going to see your face and I'm going to wait for your reaction. Thank you for reacting to that.
That's about all I can play. Anyway.
Why the rush for seals?
Yeah, why? You know, I guess it was diversifying their market. Mm. And, you know, seals. seals were sold, you know, in exchange for money.
Yeah.
You know, tea, whatever they were selling that they didn't have, they'd get that, right? So
I didn't know that there was so much oil that would come from there.
I always thought seals were about fur and meat. I didn't know about the oil either.
True.
And I didn't know about that elephant seals have a bigger amount of oil and that the oil that whales have burns clean. Like, they all burn clean. Yeah.
Jeez.
So, and, you know, considering you got lamps.
Yeah.
You have to light because there's no electricity.
Uh-huh.
Oil becomes a big commodity.
Man.
And most of the, you know, there's seals in different parts of the world, but, you know, around this time, New Zealand's surrounding islands and bottom of the south had a lot of seal stock.
Okay.
So seals, you know, they did start doing sealing in Bass Strait, which is above Tasmania, between Tasmania and Australia, the island of Tasmania. But see, when they exhausted those stocks, they started coming down as well.
Okay.
So in the context of that, of, you know, the convict transportation to Australia, there were many sealers who were convicts.
Yeah.
They were either freed already and they weren't under any sort of colonial control, or they were running away from the control on Australia. So a really easy way to get out of Australia is jump on a whaling ship.
True.
Get dumped in an island somewhere in the middle of nowhere with your boys and, you know, maybe sleep under an upturned boat hull and brave the weather and kill seals for 6 months until the ship comes back and collects everything that you've done.
Talking about braving the weather, I'm just going to come to the warning we just had a couple of days ago. I know this is away from what we're talking about, tsunami and stuff like that.
Yep.
Jeez, man.
Yeah.
That was pretty scary for me.
It was pretty intense. And I was getting really excited. I wanted to see if it was going to happen.
The things that excite you. You know, I'm thinking to myself, I am not going to go to places like Island Bay.
Yeah.
I'm not going anywhere where there's water. I'm not.
But you live in town. You know, the harbour used to come right up to Lambton Quay at one point.
Seriously?
So, yes.
Yeah.
So basically, if I was in the city and I was thinking, parking my car on a hill for this moment. No, you're not going to be on any flat plane. around Lambton Quay or anywhere there.
How intense does it get? Like,
well, I've never been anywhere when there's a tsunami. I've only seen them on movies. So. Okay. But, I mean, you know, like you can look at what was happening. I think it was, was it Thailand?
Mm-hmm.
Or it was Taiwan or Thailand, one of those, you know, up in the Southeast Asia,
yeah.
when the tsunami came in, it just sort of comes in like a massive long wave that just doesn't stop. Oh. It doesn't look as massive as the Hollywood ones where they're like 12 stories high.
Oh yeah, that's what I was picturing, because I saw myself driving. I do a lot of driving these days, so I was like, what if I'm at Island Bay and then next thing,
yeah, would it just come in like a huge wave that sort of like. What it looked like on the videos that I've seen on YouTube, it just keeps going.
Oh, okay.
And flooding everything. So it just, and it's forceful. You know?
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
But it was coming all the way from Russia, so I think it would have been pretty worn out by the time it got down to us.
Well.
It was probably Japan would be more, because it's closer.
It's closer, yeah.
And they were warning that it could wrap around, so that's... That's, you know, but Newtown, I live in Newtown, which is a valley surrounded by hills. We are the place for the southern part of Wellington.
Mm-hmm.
They have to come to us or come to another valley so that you can see where the tsunami lines are when you go over the hill to Kilburnie or go over the hill to Southgate, or you go over the hill anywhere else, you see where the tsunami lines are. Okay. So we're kind of like a little... valley that's protected by those hills, so I'm not really worried.
Now, talking about, you know, braving the weather, they were braving the weather, chilling there for 6 months or whatever.
Yeah.
Waiting
And you know, why were black men on? Well, you know, like, there were lots of reasons to get out of where you were, I guess. You know, to me, I don't think if I was transported as a convict to Australia that I would feel... happy about it and want to be there.
I mean, if you look at the weather also in Australia, it's, from what I see, from what I observe, it's similar to what you'd have in Africa in a way.
Yeah, definitely. So, Western Australia is a whole other kettle of fish.
So you'd probably be happy to be in something that's familiar.
But you're still controlled.
True.
You know, like you're a convict, but you're a convict for a period of time. It could be up to 10 years. Most of them were getting sentenced to 7 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and then you might have a period of, you know, like, I don't know, parole?
Yeah, probably.
And there was things like tickets. So if you had to have your ticket with you all the time, if you didn't have your ticket, you'd get arrested again, get charged again.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so there's this constant control and keeping people in one place. I would, you know, if I was a guy that was, you know, young and strong and happy and, you know, like suddenly you're ripped. You've been taken from Africa to a thing, got into trouble over there, come down here, you know, come down to Australia. It's just control over your whole life. See, I would see the sea as freedom.
I think I think also when you've been taken from, say, Europe, and then you've been incarcerated in Australia, so to speak, you're looking at two things and saying, better to be incarcerated somewhere where I'm actually warm, where my body agrees with the climate.
Well, I would have thought that too.
Yeah.
But then there were instances where sailing gangs wouldn't jump back on the ship when it came to get them. They'd stay where they are.
Yeah.
I'm like, why? But
because they knew they were going back to the cold.
Yeah,
they didn't want to go back. That's it.
So by the, you know, it, you know, and I want to stay in the sealing area because whaling comes up next. But you know, the sustained sealing activity into the 1830s coincides with the rise of multi-ethnic sealing gangs, including African descended Australian Aboriginal men. And it was the foundation of cross-cultural communities in Bluff, Ruapuke Island, Otago Peninsula, and increased intermarriage. So the sealers often would start families locally.
Yeah.
So then they wouldn't have a reason to go back. And if you're on, say, the bottom of the South Island or somewhere, you know, on a coastal thing, not on a remote island in the middle of Wop Wop, but it might be, actually, I'm quite happy where I am.
True.
Here, let me get your sales fee. Mm-hmm. You pay me for what I'm doing, but I'm okay here with the local people. So it's not commonly recorded in New Zealand archives.
Yeah.
that sailing gangs included mixed or black or mixed race crew members, especially given the diverse makeup of maritime labor at that time. Very diverse. You've got a, you know, when you think about it globally, you've got American slaves escaping slavery in antebellum by jumping on whaling ships and sailing ships, and you've got ships from America and the Caribbean sometimes employing sailors of African descent, and sailing crews were often assembled from rough and itinerant populations.
Mm.
So I think it was Kororekareka, I think that's the correct name of the place, was actually like Wild West.
Oh, okay.
And sailors sometimes started big beefs with Māori, and Māori had beef with sailors because this was all going on before colonialism. So New Zealand was quite multicultural, which I don't think people really realise the multicultural thing that the multiculturalism that sailing and whaling brought for this product, for this resource here.
I mean, when I also look at the multicultural aspect of it, I think, in a way, it was not planned. Okay, it's not planned, of course, and they probably didn't anticipate that it would happen that way when they brought the different cultures this side.
Mm.
Do you think it was advantageous to them, or it proved a disadvantage later on?
Advantageous to who?
To the colonial powers.
I think it was by design. You know, like, sailing and whaling was rough work. It was hard work.
Okay.
And even though here a lot of the archives only talk about white men, you know, out of America there were like over 3,000 black men that were involved in that industry, whaling industry up there, escaping. So people would come to that job for different reasons. And the other thing was you could make money doing this. And you'd be paid fairly. That was the other thing about it. You know, you could escape the racialization of living on land that would have happened in Australia or, you know, in the Caribbean islands or under British colonial rule or America, right?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of that freedom to be respected as a man for what you can do as a man. You know, and it's very physical labor. But I know, you know, just quickly, you know, Chatham Islands, 1870, a population survey was undertaken. It was reported at the present time. I'm just going to read it verbatim. At the present time, the islands are inhabited by a varied and motley and assemblage of peoples as can be imagined. There are Moriores, Maoris, Kanakas, Negroes, Chinese, Spaniards, Portuguese, Danes, Germans, English, Irish, Scotch, Welsh, Yankees, a native of South America, a Manila native, a Laplander, a Russian Finn, a half-caste of New Holland, several Māori half-castes, and a few whose nationality is impossible to determine.
Wow.
Have you seen how big Chatham Island is?
It's tiny, right?
It's tiny.
Like, really tiny.
But this is, this product, this resource, seals.
Jeez.
Crazy. So I'm just going to skip right to the, and this was that was from roving mariners, Australian Aboriginal whalers and sailors in the Southern Ocean from 1790 to 1870 by Lynette Russell. And that was produced in New York.
Yeah.
State University of New York. No, I didn't find this here under our records, right? So, and also from Whaling Will Never Do It For Me, studied from the shoreside approach, there are multiple sources of such men in the Pacific. For example, they had hunted sandalwood or beachy demure or seals or run from merchantmen or as convicts escaped from Australia or Tasmania or Norfolk Island.
Mm.
But let me jump down, because I'm just looking at the time now. I want to jump down to the one name of one character. I was able to get some information because he's talked about here in New Zealand, you know, the wonderful world of the web in New Zealand.
And who could that be?
Well, this is Thomas Chaslem. So, and he was also known as Tommy Chaslem.
Mm-hmm.
And Tame Titirine. So he ended up getting a Māori name. So Thomas Chaslin Sr. was described in several secondary sources as being of African or African Caribbean heritage.
Yeah.
So he married an Aboriginal woman. And Tommy Chaslin Jr., let me just skip down to that. Tommy Chaslin Jr. was Aboriginal and African mix who came down to New Zealand and worked around the Fovo Strait area mm-hmm. and became one of the most famous sailors ever. So basically, Tommy Chaslin Sr. was convicted in England in 1791, transported to New South Wales in 1792 aboard the Royal Admiral. He fathered Tommy Chaslin, aka Tame Titirine, a well-known sailor and whaler in southern New Zealand, with an Aboriginal woman, making Tommy Jr. of African and Aboriginal descent. Chaslin settled on Rakiura, Stewart Island, and formed a relationship with Puna, a high-ranking Ngāi Tahu woman who was the daughter of a prominent leader, Koroko, and the sister of Chief Tairoa. In 1835, Chaslins and Brown harvested 11 whales in 17 days
wow.
at Mataura River, one of several small whaling stations in the Southland region. Chaslin moved frequently among whaling stations as his skills were in high demand. In 1837, he was recorded as the head man at Preservation Inlet Station on the southwestern corner of the South Island. On the 24th of April, 1838, storekeeper and diarist Octavius Harwood made a notation in his journal that whaling gear was issued to him along with a week's provisions for his gang. Chaslin, being illiterate, mm-hmm. marked the receipt with an X.
What? Wait.
Mm.
I always have a problem with this.
Mm.
Why do they always say that these guys marked receipts with X's? I mean, if you look at the story of Lobengula as well, when it comes to the selling of, well, they say that he sold Zimbabwe. They say that he marked with an X as well.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I guess it's an easy mark to make if you can't write.
Nah,
what do you think that they...
Something's not right. Why an X?
Well...
I mean, it could have been a tick or anything.
It could have been
else.
Anything.
Yeah.
Right? It could have been a squiggle. But, you know.
Exactly.
Maybe they were told to do that if you don't know how to write an X. Yeah. But in 1842, he was recorded as working at Jackson Bay, Okahu, on the southwest coast of the South Island. Next year, he was engaged by Shortland, who was undertaking a population census of southern whaling stations as the pilot of the ship Scotia.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1844, he was the manager of John Jones Whaling Station on Moturata Island off the coast of Tairi Mouth. And I haven't gotten to when he passed away.
Yeah.
But during the 1850s, he worked mainly for himself, sometimes sailing and sometimes as a pilot, most notably for the Acheron, when he was hired by Captain John Lord Stokes to assist with survey work. And I just found out Stokes Valley.
Yeah.
The guy that was why Stokes Valley's name Stokes Valley, he was a slave owner as well.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Sorry, I can't look at Wellington the same way.
Why am I not shocked?
Yeah.
But
and all the old, like, there's a, I put up a playlist on the Black House YouTube.
Yeah.
And this, I put up some interesting videos, even about convict labor and building around Wellington. Really changes the way you look at the town.
You know, when I'm actually looking at how skilled Thomas Chaslin was, Junior.
Yeah. Yeah, loved his grog, loved to drink. He could become a different person. He had quite a nice disposition, but he could be violent. There was a story about him being violent. And he had amazing eyesight. He could see better than the guy with the...
With the telescope,
with the telescope, yeah.
I wonder what his wealth sat at.
Mm.
With all that skill.
Yeah.
With his skills being in demand again.
Mm.
It just makes me wonder.
I actually...